Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's impeachment hearing before the House Intelligence Committee with National Security Council Ukraine expert Colonel Vindman and Vice President Pence's aide Jennifer Williams in the morning, and the Republican chosen witnesses Ambassador Kurt Volker and the National Security Council's Tim Morrison in the afternoon. Mark Sandalo, Associate Academic Director of the University of California Washington Center and former Washington Bureau Chief for the San Francisco Chronicle and author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, Times, and Rise to Power, joins us. We'll discuss the central role of the Californian Congressman Adam Schiff and the Californian Speaker Pelosi in the hearings underway, with Adam Schiff chairing the inquiry and Pelosi behind the scenes directing the House impeachment strategy. We'll assess whether the Republican congressman and congresswoman's efforts to slime Colonel Vindman questioning his loyalty while trying to out the whistleblower backfired, and whether the slipping TV ratings for the hearings mean the public is not engaged and is losing interest. Then we'll speak with Robert Mackey, a senior writer at The Intercept who writes about national and international news through the prism of social media, about his latest article at The Intercept, Republicans Urge Americans to Follow Them Through the Fox News Looking Glass on Ukraine. We will discuss the extent to which Republican congressmen are behaving like junkyard dogs, snapping at witnesses in the hope they will draw blood, and whether Devin Nunes' strategy of dismissing the hearings as a democratically orchestrated circus that the American people find boring will work. Then finally, we'll examine the significance of Chief Justice John Roberts' indefinite hold on making President Trump's taxes available to the Congress, and discuss the three tracks towards making Trump's returns available to the public underway with lawsuits by the New York District Attorney, the House Ways and Means Committee, and the House Oversight Committee. Edward McCaffrey, Chair in Law and Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California, and author of Fair, Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, joins us to analyze the cases and what, if any, rulings might come from the Supreme Court. And joining us now is Mark Sandalo, who's an Associate Academic Director of the University of California Washington Center and Editor-in-Chief of the California News Service. Prior to his appointment, he spent 21 years with the San Francisco Chronicle, including 11 years as the paper's Washington Bureau Chief, and he's the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, Times, and Rise to Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Sandalo.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And what do you make of today's, the second days of this week's hearings with Colonel Vindman and Jennifer Williams, Vice President Pence's aide in the morning, and of course Paul Volcker and Tim Morrison in the afternoon? And Volcker and Morrison, of course, were chosen by the Republicans. I'm not entirely sure that they've been particularly helpful to the Republicans.
Let's put it that way. They've been less damaging than the other witnesses, if that's why they maybe picked them. I mean, what we've had, and there are so many details, but the central storyline hasn't changed one bit. And it's actually the exact same storyline that the president wants everyone, you know, it's all in the transcript. And it is right there in the transcript. I mean, the basic story remains the same. The president asked the president of Ukraine for a favor, and that was to investigate Democrats and Joe Biden. And all these hearings so far have been about nuance, about, first of all, whether or not it's clear that by asking a favor, whether or not that is actually putting pressure on Ukraine. And the Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who was the National Security Council's top Ukraine aide, who showed up in his military uniforms today, I mean, he says, look, he's a military guy. Asking a favor, when the president asks the president of Ukraine for a favor, that's no different than an order. That's a demand. And I think that's the way that most people read it. And what's been interesting to watch is the substance has not changed. The Republican arguments shift a little bit, but essentially Democrats are saying this is a clear abuse of power. And Republicans have said, first of all, none of the evidence is relevant because we don't know the identity of the whistleblower. Devin Nunes, the ranking Republican, went on a long tirade this morning about how we can't take any of this seriously because the fake news media, in conjunction with the Democratic Party, isn't covering this fairly. The process isn't fair. We've yet to hear, there's a legitimate argument to be made that maybe you don't throw a president out of office for doing these things. But every witness they have brought before them has said that it was unusual or improper, or they were shocked, if not appalled, by the president's request.
Well, specifically in terms of Kurt Volker not delivering what perhaps the Republicans were hoping for, he said that the investigations Trump requested of President Zelensky amounted to conspiracy theories, and that the allegations against Vice President Biden were self-serving and not credible. And at least on two occasions, he praised Joe Biden, saying he knew him well or knows him well and thinks that this whole Burisma thing is a waste of time. And
so some of these witnesses have this really difficult line to walk, because, I mean, Volker said in previous testimony that there were no demands for an investigation into Joe Biden. And now we've got all these witnesses saying, of course there are. In fact, the transcript basically shows that. So Volker says, and Volker has decades of experience with Democrats and Republicans, but he's worked with Republicans mostly. He said that by investigation, he always took that to mean investigations into Ukraine corruption. And that's a perfectly legitimate thing for the president to have asked his counterpart in Ukraine about. In fact, the Lieutenant Colonel Vindman said that he helped prepare the talking points for these phone calls. And in corruption was on the talking points for both the phone calls that Trump made. The difference, and they all agreed with this, is when you start talking about this, they never thought of Burisma. The corruption has nothing to do with Joe Biden and his son. Maybe that stinks, and it may be awful. But that's not the kind of corruption that would be endemic to Ukraine that would justify the president withholding U.S. aid. And so they're sort of justifying why it is this way. But you're right. I don't think that the sound bites they were looking for came out right when Volker said it's ridiculous to investigate Joe Biden because he's known him for decades and he's a man of great integrity.
And Tim Morrison, who replaced Fiona Hill on the National Security Council, is in charge of Russia and Ukraine. They've tried to make something out of the idea that somehow Colonel Vindman had not contacted him or been sufficiently in contact with him and had gone first to the top lawyer on the National Security Council. Tim Morrison, basically.
He's coming back to process, which is not the fundamental issue before the impeachment committee.
Right, but basically what Morrison said was, I'm not going to speak ill of my colleagues. I admire them all, you know. So it didn't seem to really work. And again, I'm speaking with Mark Sandelow, an associate academic director of the University of California's Washington Center and editor-in-chief of the California News Service. And prior to this appointment, he spent 21 years with the San Francisco Chronicle, including 11 years as the paper's Washington bureau chief. And he's the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, Times, and Rise to Power. So I wanted to just, I framed in the opening, Mark, the idea that this is sort of dominated by a Californian who's the chair of the Intelligence Committee, and behind the scenes, Speaker Pelosi, another Californian, is orchestrating the impeachment strategy. And of course, you have to add to that another Californian. Devin Nunes is calling the whole thing a circus and trying to dismiss it out of hand as a democratically orchestrated joke. The ratings are down. So is it let's start with Nunes' strategy.
Yeah.
Is his strategy of trying to dismiss this as being boring and that Americans are turning off their TVs in droves, is that working?
Nunes, the representative, is clearly just it's appealing to the Republican base. And what he's saying is the fake news media is misreporting it. The process is not fair. Democrats have accused the president of other things, and that hasn't led to his impeachment. So why should we bother to even look into this one? None of those speak to the facts. I don't think that's not going to convince, a jury. That's not going to convince people who have open minds, or certainly not Democrats and never Trumpers. The idea here is to give talking points to Republicans because they've done a brilliant job of obfuscating, of confusing to the point where they have so many talking points at this point, the Republicans, that it's very, very hard to get to the essential fact of it. There is going to be a debate. And I would urge people to think about this. If Barack Obama in 2011 had been caught talking to the president of Mexico saying, I want you to investigate Mitt Romney, his likely opponent in the next election, I think that Republicans naturally would have called for impeachment. But even Democrats might have criticized it, but they would have said, do we really want to, Obama's bad all of a sudden? We want to throw him out of office 11 months before a new election? We want to overturn the last results? Let's let the voters decide. Ultimately, that's going to be the Republican argument. And for now, they just seem to be making fools of themselves, arguing procedural arguments that simply have zero credibility.
Well, I want to focus a little on Speaker Pelosi, because I think it was on Meet the Press a couple of days ago, and she's somebody that's had a number of face-to-face meetings with President Trump. And I find her the most useful in describing who this man is and how he behaved, because it's pretty clear that the American public have no idea what goes on inside the Oval Office. And if they did, they might well be alarmed. And we don't know about this health issue with the sudden him rushing to the hospital on Saturday to Walter Reed. Some rumors suggest that we know he has tantrums and he gets into a total state. And whether or not these rumors are true, and you have to pretty much dismiss them until learn otherwise. But the suggestion is that he really did just go into a rage, and then they got so worried that they had to take him off to hospital. So I don't know whether any of that's true, but we do know that he goes into these tantrums and stuff. But the way that she describes who he is and why he's behaving the way he does, I find the most credible, in the sense she says, look, this is a man who we know he didn't really want the job. It was made clear by Michael Cohen that he thought the whole campaign was a lark and that this would improve the Trump organization's brand. So the worst thing that happened to him was he actually got elected, and he suddenly was finding himself doing a job that he's completely out of his depth doing. And she thinks, Pelosi thinks, that that's at the heart of it. This is a man who's flaying about and attacking everybody, right, left, and center, because he's acting out because he's terrified and he can't do the job and he's screwing up terribly. And frankly, that to me is the most credible thing I've ever heard about him. But I'm not sure that the word is getting out.
If Trump were Superman, Nancy Pelosi is his kryptonite. I mean, Nancy Pelosi has found a way to handle President Trump that almost none of the other opponents have. I mean, now he's stuck on Nervous Nancy. But it took him several years to come up with a nickname for her, because she is unlike anybody he's, I think, ever worked with before. And they are political opposites. I mean, there's a woman, Nancy Pelosi, who is a master of the process. She's a master of politics, of behind the scene, of building coalitions, and she's not terribly good communicator. I mean, she can't go on. A reality TV show starring Nancy Pelosi would not do very well. But Donald Trump is exactly the opposite. And naturally, she does not like his politics. I'm not sure that Nancy Pelosi, in her heart of hearts, he really wanted this impeachment to happen this way, because Nancy Pelosi, more than anything, wants to get Democrats elected. Her number one priority is Democrats winning control of the Senate, keeping control of the House, and winning the White House so that her legislative agenda can get pushed. And I think for her, the impeachment is simply a political calculation. Is it more likely or less likely that 18 months from now we have Democratic majorities or not? And, she's been pushed from the left, from people who are, disgusted by Trump. And I'm sure she is just as disgusted as they are by Trump. But for her, it has always been a pragmatic calculation about how do we best elect Democrats. She always opposed impeachment of Trump up until this latest Ukraine charge came out. Back in the Iraq War, there were a lot of Democrats who insisted that she lead impeachment fight against George W. Bush. And her point was, yes, he should not be in office. Yes, he ought to be impeached. But what do? We suck all the political energy out of Washington for month after month. And even if we're successful, we end up with Dick Cheney as president. Why would we do that?
Well, she's right in the sense that it does suck the oxygen out of whatever the Democrats are going to be offering up in 2020 as their agenda and their vision for America, for a better America. Already you see that happening. I mean, tomorrow is going to be really, I think, if the ratings have been low for the last 2 days, I think they might be a little higher tomorrow when Gordon Sondland is faced with whether or not he perjured himself. But all the analysis and all the punditry is going to be clashing with the fact that tomorrow night there is a Democratic presidential debate. And that's already getting overshadowed, don't you think?
No doubt. I mean, people in Washington are as serious, policy-minded, political animals as I've ever seen. And I think that if you had a choice right now watching Gordon Sondland testify tomorrow, or, and they'll be at different times, but or the Democrat debate, 90% of Washington would want to hear about the impeachment. I mean, there's one that is breaking news that is, That's much more dramatic, and talk about whether or not we implement a Medicare for Plan All or a Medicare for All Who Want It plan and the timelines of that, I think seem tiresome. And if people in Washington believe that, you know, you can only imagine what normal people think of this. I mean, the Democratic debate is going to seem as if it's sort of off point, which is a problem for the Democrats. And they also face a problem in that there's going to be a Senate trial almost certainly, because the chances of impeachment are very high. There's a Senate trial. You know, you've got all these senators in there, you know, Warren and Sanders and Booker, Kamala Harris. All of them are going to sit there at the trial to serve as jurors, and you know, they can't be on the campaign trail. So this is, I think, the reason that a lot of Democrats thought impeachment was not a good idea. It certainly wasn't because they were timid or because they thought that Donald Trump doesn't deserve to be impeached. But the evidence keeps mounting, and I think here is the Democrats' electoral hope. I think Pelosi is trying to push this as much as possible. With every line, Republicans, can I say, make a reasonable argument that you don't throw a president out of office for this. But for Republicans to insult lifetime military and foreign service officers for possibly being spies or, you know, betraying their country for testifying here, for Republicans to insist that whistleblower protections are unnecessary, or that it's completely reasonable for the President of the United States to ask the President of Ukraine to investigate his political rival, these are not things that are going to help the Republicans, you know, next year or 4 years from now or 8 years from now. And I'm sure that they have got, you know, the tape rolling so they can use some of these idiotic lines that Republicans have come up with in defense to use against them for years to come.
Well, Mitch McConnell, the head of the Senate, is already signaling that he thinks that the Senate trial will certainly be in January, and it could go up pretty close to the Iowa caucuses, couldn't it?
Absolutely. I think the caucuses are the first week of February.
Right.
And
right.
You know, this happened in... for those of us who were around in the 90s when this happened to Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was going to be impeached about December 17th. He ended up attacking, firing missiles, and giving a nationally addressed speech the eve of impeachment. So they put it off for a couple of days. He was impeached in late December. The Senate held a trial, and they voted, I think, the second week of February to not throw him out of office. So you got to figure that's, you know, likely the schedule that we're on now. Somewhere between Thanksgiving and Christmas, the impeachment vote happens. Somewhere between New Year's and President's Day, the Senate trial will wrap up.
So given that the ratings are slipping and that the Republicans are trying to, and particularly Nunes and others are trying to dismiss this as being a big yawn, what do you think is going to pick up the numbers? Obviously, the Watergate that they compare it to, that was a slow burn. It was almost 18 months long, and it only got sort of interesting towards the end, or at least got really interesting once Alex Butterfield revealed the tapes. But this one started out with the evidence, if you will. The smoking gun started out this whole impeachment from the top, which is the transcript of the conversation Trump had with Zelensky. So is that a problem, that you're sort of starting out with your big guns? And the other problem that's often mentioned is that maybe there are other articles that are possible to impeach Trump on if stronger than this Ukraine story, which, of course, the Republicans have tried to obfuscate. And I don't know what judgment you could make about how well the Democrats are making it clear that this is an impeachable offense.
And don't forget the last two impeachment inquiries into both Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton both had years-long investigations by special prosecutors who had gathered up reams, volumes of evidence already, which is what the House is in the process of collecting right now. I mean, here's the problem with lots of American policy right now. Issues are more complicated and have more nuance than the attention span of, you know, cable television. So you cannot have, although you wouldn't know it from turning on TV, bombshells at every moment. It's not breaking news every time any of these witnesses open their mouths. The fact that it's boring is not necessarily an indictment of the process. It's just that there are a lot of complicated issues, and it ought to be taken very, very seriously. And I think it perfectly, you know, jibes against the President of the United States, who made his fortunes, well, partly in real estate, but he got then his national reputation for being a reality TV host. And he turned politics into reality TV. He was masterful at the Republican debates because there was never a dull moment. Who's going to waste their time talking about, different Republican plans for health care when he's out there insulting people about the way that they look and bragging about his own masculinity. That was a lot more interesting to a lot of people. That's certainly great entertainment. It's not necessarily good politics. And I think with this impeachment hearings, Democrats are doing their best to keep it lively. But the truth is that this is a long, plotting process, and it has to be that way because you don't want decisions to be made on impeachment the way they're made on a reality TV show.
Well, but in closing, Mark Sandow, how far have we moved into a kind of Jerry Springer culture?
It's a great question, and it's a real problem. I do think that the Jerry Springer is a perfect analogy of somebody who provoked fights and then acted shocked when the fights happened. I think the news media has a large role in this, and that you put two people on television, you don't want to get two serious policy analysts get on there. You want somebody who says his idea is stupid or her idea is ridiculous and people are fighting, it's good entertainment. And I do think that there is a real problem for that. This is typically where sort of the adults in the room have tried to step forward in a bipartisan way and say, look, we have serious business here. But I think people are reasonable to ask, where are the adults in the room at this point? And it's not clear where they are. So, yeah, we're stuck right now with reality TV politics, and it certainly seems unhealthy.
Well, Mark Sandalow, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Sandalow, who's an associate academic director of the University of California's Washington Center and editor-in-chief of the California News Service. Prior to his appointment, he spent 21 years with the San Francisco Chronicle, including 11 years as the paper's Washington bureau chief, and he's the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, Times, and Rise to Power. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
No, welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Mackey, who's a senior writer at The Intercept, who writes about national and international news through the prism of social media. Previously, he was a reporter and columnist for The New York Times, where he anchored the newspaper's breaking news blog, The Lead, for 5 years and wrote a news analysis column, Open Source, from 2014 to 2016. And his latest article at The Intercept is Republicans Urge Americans to Follow Them Through the Fox News Looking Glass on Ukraine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Mackey.
Thanks, Ian.
So the Republican congressman and congresswoman that at times are sort of acting like junkyard dogs, just yapping and trying to draw blood, are they performing for Fox, or are they actually trying to do something useful here in terms of defending President Trump?
Well, I mean, it could be, of course, both. I wonder, it does seem to be the case that their strategy seems to be essentially to deflect from the testimony of career officials who either witnessed or took part in this scheme to extort basically a sham investigation into Joe Biden by the Ukrainian authorities. So it can be hard to tell watching all this go on. You know, they're spouting conspiracy theories, but they're telling some pretty easily disproved lies about specific Ukrainians in the course of this. It could be because those have become generally accepted as truth on Fox News and in the right-wing media. It could be because they believe them. I'm not sure, but they don't really bear, they don't stand up under close examination.
So no amount of evidence that the reporter for The Hill, John Solomon, got it wrong and that he was misled by Lukashenko, who everybody in Ukraine understands as a complete criminal, and his job, the most lucrative job you could ever have in Ukraine, was to be the chief prosecutor, because that way you could shake down people that you could threaten to prosecute and they'd pay you off and send money to a Cyprus bank account if you didn't prosecute them. And then he could also go to other people and say, why don't you pay me and I'll prosecute your enemies. So that's who that guy was. And that's the guy that President Trump praised and said was a good guy who was badly treated by Joe Biden. So are we, it's truly in post-truth America here? Is it impossible for truth to prevail over these weaponized lies?
Well, we're going to find out, unfortunately. I mean, it is interesting that the way in which, misinformation, disinformation is just so prevalent now. It can seem like a sort of social media era thing, but in some ways it's really just about reporting, and readers, viewers, listeners have to decide who to trust to help them interpret facts and information. And these sorts of things have been going on for a while. I mean, you'll recall that the campaign of lies and slander against John Kerry during 2004's election was not really propelled by the internet. These are things that Republicans have, practiced before. But in this case also, of course, because this is about Ukraine, a country that most Americans know very little about, it's fairly easy to bend the truth and essentially invert it. But it's a challenge to try and sift through it all and make sense of it. It's definitely true also that, John Solomon, but also Ken Vogel of The New York Times have, helped create some confusion and fed conspiracy theories, not always intentionally, but just through a sort of selective attention to certain facts and dismissing others. About what really has been going on in Ukraine. But what I find fascinating is how it's really become a total inversion. What you have right now is the Republican Party and the Trump administration essentially supporting these corrupt officials and oligarchs in Ukraine against the reformists who ousted the pro-Russian president in 2014. It's quite perverse.
Well, you're right, Robert Mackey, but I don't think that Democrats are framing it in that way, and I wish they would. I wish they'd point out, because, the Republicans do the ritual thing of saying, with Volcker, for example, this afternoon, you're really fighting against corruption, and you recognized that Zelensky was the real deal, and you had to support him. At the same time, putting out the opposite narrative, as you say, because at the end of the day, the question that should be asked, surely, of the Republicans defending Trump is, whose side was Trump on? The side of the Ukrainians or the side of the Russians? And invariably, he ends up on the side of the Russians, and in fact, almost consistently.
Well, that's true that in this case, the conspiracy theory that he specifically asked Zelensky to lend credence to by opening an investigation about the 2016 election was this sort of crazy idea that the Ukrainians were the real colluders, that somehow they were the people who interfered in the election. And this is something that it's a narrative that obviously suits the Russians because it distracts attention from, the very real and a quite obvious campaign of interference based on email hacking and, social media manipulation. And it's also the case, I guess, in another way, it's very simple because, really the root of all this, as Rudy Giuliani has said, the president's private lawyer, he started looking into Ukraine essentially to figure out what happened at the beginning with Paul Manafort, the Trump campaign manager, who had been a political consultant for, all manner of despots and dictators around the world, but most recently for the president who was ousted in 2014 and fled to Russia, Yanukovych. So Giuliani, acting on information from Manafort, started looking at Ukraine to try and prove that Manafort was framed, that the charges against him were false, which it's all extremely absurd, of course, because Manafort is serving 7.5 years in federal prison because he did commit tax crimes by concealing his income from Ukraine. The whole thing is in one way predictable. It's the Republican establishment now is siding with Paul Manafort, a longtime Republican operative who, has been around for years.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Mackey, who's a senior writer at The Intercept, who writes about national and international news through the prism of social media. Previously, he was a reporter and columnist for The New York Times, where he anchored the newspaper's breaking news blog, The Lead, for 5 years, and wrote a news analysis column, Open Source, from 2014 to 2016. And his latest article at The Intercept is Republicans Urge Americans to Follow Them Through the Fox News Looking Glass on Ukraine. But again, Jim Jordan was going on today in questioning Volcker again in the afternoon, saying, going on about some Ukrainian ambassador writing an op-ed back in 2016 that was critical of Trump. I mean, I don't understand why the Democrats can point out the obvious. Ukrainians have every reason to hate Paul Manafort. He was the PR guy, the election guy that got Yanukovych elected. He was standing beside Yanukovych when he ordered snipers to shoot down the young protesters in the Maidan, 106 of whom were murdered. And then Trump, they have every right to be skeptical of Trump, who has said on a number of occasions that he thinks the Russians have got a good and legitimate claim to Crimea. So it seems like a totally absurd a claim on the part of the Republicans to say that there was some, sort of subversive reason why Ukraine might want Hillary Clinton to get elected. Yeah. Well, if I was a damn Ukrainian, I tell you, I'd want to get elected. I wouldn't want anybody whose campaign manager is Paul Manafort, for God's sake.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's right. The op-ed that they're referring to as though it was some incredibly nefarious, underhanded collusion with the Democrats was by a Ukrainian ambassador who was horrified by Trump's comments during the 2016 campaign, suggesting that, you know, Crimea should stay with Russia, that the annexation and occupation of Ukrainian territory was fine, basically. So, yeah, it's asking a bit much for politicians from a country that's been attacked and invaded shouldn't express any opinions about something that strong of someone who suggests that, you know, their enemy is fine. So, yeah, that's another absurdity here.
So let's turn a little bit to the article that you have at The Intercept, Republicans Urge America to Follow Them Through the Fox News Looking Glass on Ukraine. And do you think that the tactic, and certainly that what was expressed by Devin Nunes by saying that these whole hearings are democratically orchestrated circuses, and he begins, you know, circus part one, circus part two. And basically what's clearly going on is that the Republicans are trying to suggest that this whole hearing is incredibly boring and that the American people are turning off their TV sets in droves. And I think to some extent, the figures on viewership doesn't necessarily support that, but apparently viewership has dropped down. I don't know whether it'll pick up tomorrow with Sondland, who I think probably will attract more viewers because, frankly, he could be charged with perjury.
Yes, he's certainly on the hook, Gordon Sondland. I mean, it's difficult. I think I quoted in my article Virginia Tilley, who's an academic, a political scientist, who's written very interestingly about the Middle East. But she was saying that, you know, sort of one of the scariest things about the national crisis unfolding right now is that this resort to lies and conspiracy theories by the Republicans has essentially made the impeachment hearing so repellent that few people can bear to tune in, or at least tune in for long, and that might be sort of their strategy to keep people from paying too close attention to it. It's a very sobering and depressing sort of realization. But I have to say, it's true that if you dig into these things and you try to follow all of the crazy stuff that's said on Fox, and you know, just try to annotate the conspiracy theories mentioned during the hearings, I mean, it's really dumb stuff. It's very difficult to believe that they can sell this stuff to the American people. But of course, they're also selling it to people who are living busy lives. They have, you know, real problems of their own. Who has the bandwidth to follow all these things, you know, except people like us?
Well, is that the inherent problem then for the Democrats in taking this particular article of impeachment on the Ukraine issue as their centerpiece, when there may be stronger, more accessible articles to impeach Trump on? And certainly I think that might be why Nancy Pelosi started to bringing up bribery, which is in the Constitution, since high crimes and misdemeanors don't exactly grab people.
True. I mean, it's, you know, metaphorically, it's not hard to understand really that this is extortion. I mean, you know, Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, is quite desperate for American military aid and a show of support from the White House. You know, there's an active war going on. Ukrainians are dying at the front line. And he's being encouraged basically by Trump to just settle with Russia. So you can see why, if he really thought that the military aid was not going to come, and there was a deadline, you know, but by the end of September, the aid would have expired. You can see why he was willing to do even this crazy stunt that essentially Giuliani and Sondland and Kurt Volker were pushing him to do at Trump's behest, to go on CNN and announce sham investigations of Joe Biden. It's not hard to understand that in a way, that that was a kind of extortion. But it's also remarkable how close that scheme came to working. You know, if not for the whistleblower complaint and the, you know, subsequent congressional investigation, Zelensky seemed very prepared to do that. Apparently, he was going to go on CNN, and he was already talking to Fareed Zakaria about setting up the interview.
Well, I want to talk to you about the javelins, but the extent to which the Republicans are trying to out the whistleblowers is extraordinary, and it just happened there towards the end, where this congressman, I think it was Conaway, had this long colloquy with himself looking at the chairman, Adam Schiff, going on about the whistleblower and this and that, and how your team knows all about him and we don't know, and the playing field is not level. That is such a red herring, because the whistleblower, he said specifically that his information was second and third hand from colleagues on the National Security Council and inside the White House, and he had no first-hand knowledge. So who needs the whistleblower? Why not go to the actual people who provided him the information, at least we assume so, and I bet you most of them are the ones that are testifying.
It is very weird, but you know, it's an aspect of Trump's worldview, of the Republican worldview now, is to politicize absolutely everything. So I think that's what's beneath these kind of bizarre calls for the whistleblower to come forth. Some idea that they can prove that the whistleblower had a political bias or motivation or something that they can use to discredit the entire thing, which doesn't really make any sense, since there's, you know, now this week a parade of 9 officials who are actually working for the U.S. government at the moment, or just were until recently, who either, you know, witnessed or took part in this scheme. There's a lot of much more direct firsthand evidence.
Sure.
And it does seem like just another crazy distraction to sort of like shout at the whistleblower.
Well, the other distraction is the Javelin missiles, which the Republicans keep saying, oh, only Trump brought them and Obama wouldn't let them have them. Well, guess what? The Javelin missiles are stashed underground bunkers in the west of Ukraine. They're not on the front. They're not allowed to go near the front. And the Ukrainians on the front line are using mock-up phony ones just to fool the Russians. So they're not exactly unconditional, shall we say, these javelins. And I thank you for joining us, Robert Mackey.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Mackey, who's a senior writer at The Intercept, who writes about national and international news through the prism of social media. Previously, he was a reporter and columnist for The New York Times, where he anchored the newspaper's breaking news blog, The Lead, for 5 years, and wrote a news analysis column, Open Source, from 2014 to 2016. And his latest article at The Intercept is Republicans Urge Americans to Follow Them Through the Fox News Looking Glass on Ukraine.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Deborah McCaffrey, who's the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward McCaffrey.
Great to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you, Ed. And let's try and get a handle on all of these efforts to get Donald Trump's tax returns. Of course, he's the first president in the modern era since Richard Nixon to refuse to make his taxes public. And not just presidents, but presidential candidates adhere to that, except for Trump. But there are many, many cases going. There's a New York State case. And just a couple of days ago, Chief Justice John Roberts ordered an indefinite stay on the House of Representatives' demand for Donald Trump's financial records. And that seemed like a big deal, but it's not, in the sense that the House committee's got till Thursday to respond. The Supreme Court justices are meeting on Friday. There's more than one case coming their way. So what do you make of the indefinite stay?
Yeah, so more confusion, as you laid out, you know, very nicely. Not that you were confused, Ian, but more confusion, something that every president since Nixon, as you said there, Ian, has done voluntarily, and most presidential candidates do voluntarily. Here we have a president of the United States just absolutely kicking and screaming and spending inordinate time and inordinate amounts of money, we should say taxpayer money, is going into defending President Trump against the obligation to disclose his tax returns. But to get to some of the facts, as you alluded to Ian, there are two cases, kind of a pincer movement, that are very active right now trying to get these tax returns. One comes up from Manhattan, the district attorney in Manhattan, the city of New York, who is looking into criminal matters involving the Trump Organization. And he's gotten a ruling from a court in New York that the accounting firm, Trump's accounting firm, Mazars, has to disclose the tax returns. Well, immediately Trump went in and appealed that state and city ruling into the federal system. And the Second Circuit has said the Manhattan district attorney is absolutely right. He absolutely has the right to get these tax returns to pursue his criminal investigations. And, of course, as soon as that happens, the Trump side files an appeal up to the Supreme Court. That's case one. The other case in the pincer movement is coming from the House of Representatives. And here's one thing. You can't really keep track of any of this without a scorecard. There was, as maybe most of your listeners, if they ever knew this, have probably forgotten this, there was a whistleblower before the Ukraine whistleblower. There was a whistleblower from inside the IRS who whistleblew that the audit of Trump's tax returns, a mandatory required thing, we should actually say it could be Trump or Pence's, but the mandatory audit of the president and or vice president's tax returns, there's something wrong in that process, according to the whistleblower. There's been, this will be a shock to you, Ian, there's been political influence exerted or attempted to be exerted on the IRS to block the IRS from doing a routine, statutorily required audit of the presidential tax returns. So on that front, our second front, the House of Representatives, using a statute that's been on the books since 1924 that says the House Ways and Means Committee has access to anyone's tax returns, the House Ways and Means Committee, pursuing the whistleblower complaint, has asked for those returns. And the Second Circuit in the federal system has said that the House Ways and Means Committee, Congress, absolutely has a right to that. So we have two courts ruling on two different cases that Trump's tax returns have to be turned over. That's not good enough for our taxpayer, our non-taxpayer in chief, President Trump. He's fighting both cases. And the ruling you're talking about here, we're talking about here today, Ian, is on Monday, Justice Roberts said, you know what, let's wait on the whole thing. Let's just not force the disclosure, which would have been the Second Circuit's disclosure to the House. Let's not force that until the court has an opportunity to look at everything, They may not take either appeal. They may let the lower court ruling stand, but they want to take a moment, take their breath, and sort through this, because even for professional jurists like the United States Supreme Court, this is a mess. This is a tangle of different arguments, often specious arguments, but we really have a president who's just kicking and screaming against Ukrainian witnesses and against any attempt whatsoever to have his tax returns see the light of day.
And again, I'm speaking with Edward McCaffrey, who's the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page. But when you say, Ed, that there's case one is the one from the New York and that went through the Second Circuit, it was a pretty airtight ruling by the three members of the Second Circuit, and then it went on bank because Trump challenged it. That meant the whole full bench, and they ruled in equally in an airtight way. That's going to the Supreme Court. And most legal analysts I've talked to say the Supreme Court would have a hard time overturning the Second Circuit's opinion unless it behaved in a very partisan way. Then you got case number two. You talked about that's Richie Neal, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, has every right. The law makes it clear. That one's been blocked by Mnuchin. But my understanding is that the stay that Justice Roberts issued on Monday was to the House Oversight Committee, and they say they need the president's tax returns in order to address whether it should update ethics in government legislation. So is there a third case?
Well, there may be. There may be. I mean, the case coming through the court is I might have said the Second Circuit before. It's the D.C. Circuit
right. On
the House case. But I thought it was the Ways and Means Committee that had the court ruling. Mm-hmm. But you think it's the Oversight Committee that has the court?
Well, that is what the ruling was. The indefinite stay was against the House Oversight Committee, and they were the ones that were given till Thursday to respond.
I see. So that would be a third matter. That would be a third case. Those are three. That's Neal and the House Ways and Means Committee pursuing the whistleblower complaint. That's the House Oversight Committee, maybe also triggered by the whistleblower complaint. And then there's the Manhattan District Attorney. And I may have said it was the Second Circuit. Like, I may have used the Second Circuit wrongly. It would be the D.C. Circuit that's been ruling. The lower court judges in D.C. and then the D.C. Circuit. So I think all roads are leading to this. You've got at least two House committees looking for the tax returns. You've got the Manhattan District Attorney looking for the tax returns. The Trump administration is fighting it on all fronts, and cases that really, to be completely honest, normally wouldn't even get a moment of attention from the Supreme Court. These statutes are very clear. No other white-collar or even a non-white-collar criminal defendant could seek to block his or her tax returns from a prosecutor. That does not happen in America. If you're suspected of committing a crime, the government has the right, the different branches of the government have the right to look at your tax returns. You don't need to be suspected of committing a crime for the House, either the Ways and Means pursuant to a very clear statute or the Oversight Committee pursuant to the constitutional obligation to oversee the executive branch. Those are three very solid feet to stand on, and no criminal defendant that I've ever heard of has gone up to the United States Supreme Court and had a case heard about the disclosure of tax returns. So our president is already getting special treatment just by having the Supreme Court take so much time to consider this. And the question will be, do they take these cases? Do they grant cert? Do they take the appeal from the D.C. Circuit and the Second Circuit? Or do they just say simply, you know what, there's nothing to see here. The law is so clear. Let's get the tax returns out to the appropriate authorities.
So is this another case where the president is claiming executive privilege and that the OLC, Justice Department, finding that you can't prosecute a sitting president would come into play? I mean, it seems a bit odd to me that we're talking about tax returns
well before the President Trump was a president.
Correct.
Citizen Trump and the Trump Organization. So my understanding, and I mentioned it earlier, and I'd like to get your opinion on it, is that the New York District Attorney's case, which the D.C. Circuit has ruled on twice, and in both cases they've sent airtight cases up, or what appear to be airtight cases up. So the challenge to the Supreme Court would be to find a way to rule against the D.C. full bench finding. And I understand that they've crafted in such a way that they don't, the Supreme Court doesn't have a lot of room to maneuver unless they decide to go a partisan route. And would they then, if they did that, could they use the tried and true argument that Trump is using all along, which is that I'm the president, I have executive privilege, and the OLC ruling protects me?
Well, certainly. I mean, the end of your question there, Ian, points to the real ultimate fear here, which is that we're degenerating further into lawlessness and this unitary executive, this all-power executive on steroids. I think when you look through their arguments here, they tend not to so much be executive privilege. Their problems with executive privilege arguments, among other things, these are tax returns from the Trump Organization. As you've said, they're asking for tax returns that go back 8 years, well before he was the president. You don't have executive privilege in your tax returns. You have the normal confidentialities that people would have in their tax returns, but you don't have more than that. So, and in Trump land, what you do is when one bad argument falls by the wayside, you raise another bad argument. So here we've heard arguments such as that Congress doesn't have a legitimate legislative purpose. In the Manhattan case, you get the president can't be indicted, you can't bring a criminal case against the president, therefore you can't do investigation, although in the New York case that falls by the wayside because it's not just Trump himself personally who's under criminal investigation, it's also the Trump Organization, it's also other individuals. So in the case of the House Ways and Means Committee, Trump lawyers are arguing that there's an implicit requirement in the statute, which does not seem to have an implicit requirement, that Congress must have, quote, a legitimate legislative purpose. That's not in the statute. And not only is it not in the statute, but if you need a legitimate legislative purpose, how about oversight of the executive? How about the whistleblower's complaint suggesting that there's political influence on the IRS performing its audit capacity? So in Trump land, you get bad arguments. You get them all the time. And that leads to the fear that a partisan court, not hewing to the law, not caring about what's written down in the statute, but just willing to really kind of prostrate itself to the president, would they go along in this obsession with preventing disclosure of the tax returns? And I would say if they do that, if they're willing to concede to the president on such a black and white, clerical, as you keep saying, Ian, airtight argument in both New York and D.C. relative to all three of the Manhattan District Attorney, the House Oversights Committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, throw in the Second District of New York if you want, SDNY, all of those organizations or entities have very powerful, legitimate, historically based and statutorily based arguments to get these tax returns. So if the Supreme Court finds some way to not have these tax returns disclosed, I would say that's a very worrisome sign for what's going to happen if and when this Supreme Court makes other decisions in this impeachment process, really in this presidency.
Well, along with coming up with one bogus argument after another, isn't the real attention here is the delaying tactic, ignoring subpoenas, et cetera, or forcing the House to go to court? And that takes months and months. So it seems like New York has actually sped this process up. And the fact that it's already got to the Supreme Court is in itself a victory, arguably, for the House, since the White House's delaying tactic is so obvious. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's a master strategy here of just continuing to kick any and every can down the road until it's too late to do anything about it. So, I mean, hopefully that's November 2020, but if it's going to be 2024, it's going to be whatever, we can expect this president to continue to obfuscate, which is why, really, I think one of the most interesting questions here, Ian, as we're talking about this Justice Roberts kind of clerical decision on Monday to just put everything on pause. They have asked for further materials from the House committees by Thursday. And there's some sense if they decide not to take these appeals, these are not appeals that the Supreme Court would normally take. These are not controversial matters of law. There's no disagreement among the lower courts about how to read these laws. These laws have been on the books. The case of the disclosure of the tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee, we're coming up on nearly 100 years. That's Warren Harding. Like, you and I are the only people who remember Warren Harding, Ian. Nobody remembers him, but he was a corrupt president, too. And he had to give his tax returns over. So these are not good arguments, and I think the thing to really watch for is, does the Supreme Court get rid of them quickly? Do they just deny cert? Do they say, from a legal point of view, there's nothing to see here? If they do take the cases, are they committed to an expedited schedule? Otherwise, you have this kind of intermediate category where if the Supreme Court isn't totally prostrate to the President of the United States, they're at least aiding and abetting his delaying tactic. And you're absolutely right, Ian, that delay and distraction and confusion, I think very, very few Americans are paying any attention whatsoever to this tax return story because we've got a soap opera on TV about something else. We're figuring out how to pronounce Kyiv or Kiev. That's the Trump scandal du jour. Right. And taxes, which go back to before the election, before the 2016 election, he was being asked to disclose his tax returns, and he said he would when the audit was over. Now it seems like there might be a corrupt audit that's not even taking place. So the whole thing is distraction, confusion, and delay, as you've said. And if he can't win everything, he's at least going to try to push it off as long as possible.
Well, just in closing, Ed McCaffrey, the easiest way out for the Supreme Court then would be simply to not to take the case, right? They're meeting on Friday, but
absolutely right. If we were going after Ian Bremmer for his, you did something afoul of the law, and some prosecutor, some government office, some House committee wanted to see your tax returns, they would have them approximately by tomorrow. And in the case of Trump, he's been fighting this for years. And, you know, it would be a nice thing if the Supreme Court could just inject a dose of normalcy by saying this is not the kind, we are not here as the Supreme Court of the United States of America to hear cases that are so clear as these particular cases, even if the President of the United States happens to be a party.
Well, Edward McCaffrey, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always my pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Edward McCaffrey. He's the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night. The headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.